And hello, universe. This is Matt Kramer at Ordinary Miracles, and usually you'd hear the dulcet tones of Jan Sircone. But as we speak, Jan is in Egypt. She's been talking about that. She's leading a tour, Journey of the Heart, anchoring world peace and harmony. And if you wanted to go on that tour, well, you better fly fast. Anyway, thanks for tuning in. This is the show that happens every Wednesday at 9 o'clock here in a little place called Cotati, California. I know by the miracles of the Internet, you there listening could be anywhere in the world. So thank you for listening. Oh, announcements I might do a little later. I guess I'm supposed to do a bit of a commercial. That's what part of what the show's about. So we'll talk about Jan first, Jan Sircone. And if you go to... Was it As Above, So Below? I'm realizing I have the wrong page up on the website for her. Oh, it's Music for Joy and Healing. That's what it is. There it is. MusicForJoyAndHealing.com. And that's the website for Jan. And the show is about sound and healing and many tangents that come off of that. So Jan does something called Voice Bio. And my understanding is you'll talk into a microphone for a minute. And it's recording the frequencies, and by what tones through the musical scale are strong or weak, Jan can get an assessment of what's going on with your physiological health. And if the tone is low, among other things, because it's much more complex than I can remember, but you'll play that tone for a few minutes a day. Like I'm supposed to play the tone of G, and that'll help my digestion, which generally is pretty good anyway, but... That's a little bit about Voice Bio, and to learn more about Jan, go to musicforjoyandhealing.com. And I do a form of emotional healing using the voice called voice mapping. And with a connection between muscle and memory, that's the basis for this. Evidently, the brain really extends throughout the entire neural map of the body, and there are places where memory resides in muscle and gets stimulated when you're in an environment that may have some connection or some challenge that resonates with something that happened earlier in your life. So if you, for example, if you're talking about your mom or a car accident and then you're being recorded with the voice map equipment, the voice map will show what emotions are connected to memories that you may not even be thinking about. It could be subconscious, but still impact how you behave or respond in those circumstances. By taking those recorded frequencies and playing them back to you in a biofeedback process, it helps release that place of subconscious tension and stress and allows you to be more present instead of being subtly jerked like a puppet on a string, is one way to put it. So that's a little insight to that. To learn more about voice mapping, you can go to my website, mattkramer.com. And if you're listening to this show, you can see how that's spelled online. So when Jan's here, we generally banter a little bit, and one of the things she asks is, what's the best and worst thing that happened this day or this week? I went to an incredible conference in Utah last week, held by the manufacturers of the equipment I use for voice mapping. And a couple of the speakers were just incredibly wonderful. Dr. Joe Dispenza and Dr. William Tiller. Dr. Tiller is a very established physicist. He was on the research staff of Westinghouse for many years. He's been on the staff of numerous colleges as a physicist, including Stanford. I think he still is connected to Stanford. And at one point, he started to look beyond the known field of physics and traditional science and got more into the quantum world. And he did some experiments working with meditators using sealed samples of water under laboratory conditions, and under some distance away, the meditators focused on raising the pH of that water, and they succeeded. And at that point, Dr. Tiller started to get challenged and actually kind of shut out of the traditional scientific community. But he overcame that, and he's doing just incredible things. So if you want to look him up, William Tiller, T-I-L-L-E-R, and my wife and I had the wonderful opportunity to have breakfast with him at the conference, and I can say it was quite moving. Dr. Joe Dispenza, D-I-S-P-E-M-Z-A, has a new book out called Evolve Your Brain. And I've just started reading it. The beginning aspect I remember is, as you think a thought, as you're thinking it, you're actually creating chemical responses in your body. So if it's a negative thought, the chemical reactions and other hormonal reactions are resonant with that. As they resonate, that might intensify your thinking, which then intensifies their resonation and helps to get you to a place of kind of a maybe a persistent bad mood. But you can also do the reverse. You can think positive thoughts and reverse that and just work your way out of any tough spot. So Evolve Your Brain, Dr. Joe Dispenza. And there was just a couple of wonderful experiences. And then Dr. Dispenza told one story I really like, so I've been repeating it, about when Einstein and his wife had to flee Germany because of the growing Nazi problem. And Einstein's wife was complaining that she felt so bad having to leave all these things that she'd gathered over the years, leaving mementos and the furniture, and she says, I'm so attached to them. And Albert said, well, my dear, they're not attached to you. And I just love the twist in that. We have a wonderful guest tonight, Elizabeth Moriarty. And I met Elizabeth at an event at the home of Deborah Giusti. And those of you in the Sonoma area know Deborah as the mother goddess who, among other things, created the Harmony Festival, which will have its 30th anniversary this year. And I think Jan will have a booth there, and my wife and I will definitely have our booth there. And Elizabeth was kind enough to say, yeah, I'll come talk about my life, etc. So welcome, Elizabeth Moriarty.
Thank you, Matt.
Yeah, and we were kind of talking before we got on the air, and there's a lot to talk about. So maybe the way to kick it off is, what do you want the world to know about you?
Thank you. I feel like I want the world to know that it feels good to be fully embodied. I love to be fully embodied in my sassiness and my spirit and my ingenuity, and I feel like I need to continually remind myself even that it's okay to be bright and big and playful and spontaneous and bringing our joy to the world and sharing it as much as we can and being infectious with our enthusiasm and interest and sharing that. I've done a lot in my life, and I'm happy to say I spent over a decade performing professionally with snakes and snake dancing and a lot of ritual theater and performance art, a lot of creativity. I've been facilitating and leading groups for many, many years, and that has really, in some ways, risen to the top. I'm most passionate and most interested in my path of leadership.
What kind of groups?
I facilitate community ceremonies and a lot of rituals. I've worked at Harbin Hot Springs for the last 4 or 5 years doing the community ceremonies for the solstices and equinoxes. And that's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure to be in a community that it's diverse. There's people that are coming as guests from all over the place, all walks of life. And we come together to circle. We take some time, we drop in, we make sound together, move, dance, celebrate, pray. And it's really a deep pleasure and passion for me to facilitate sacred space experiences for people.
Are you still working with snakes?
I'm not working with snakes. My snakes have all gone back underground.
Uh-huh. Well, how'd you get into working with snakes?
It was at a Harmony Festival, as a matter of fact, many, many years ago with Desert Dan and his traveling reptile pals was there at the Harmony Festival with his, he had all sorts of stuff. He had spiders crawling on his head, and he had a beautiful albino Burmese python named Sue. And she was a big yellow python, and I saw her there a couple of times, and one year I decided, okay, I'm going to ask him if I can play with his snake or hold the snake.
About 8 feet long?
It was about 8 feet long or so. So I said, hey, can I borrow your snake? And he said, sure. And he put Sue on me, and he started to walk away.
Mm.
couldn't believe it. So it was my first experience, and then I was invited to dance up on the stage for the finale. So I brought Sue, this snake, up on the stage, and I did my first snake dance in front of a huge crowd at the Harmony Festival. And that was many years ago, over a decade ago. And that started the whole thing, and I actually got an albino Burmese of my own that is a very beautiful story, how I came to adopt the beautiful python that I had for 9 years.
We have to tell that story.
Well, it might be a story for another time.
But
many people met her and had a lot of transformational experiences with Shiva Luna. We had quite a dharma, she and I. I really got that it was a healing path. Even though we were performing and dancing, she was such a gentle, beautiful, gentle, sweet creature at 10 feet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she grew to be 10 feet, but she was about 2.5 or 3 when I got her.
Okay.
So many people had transformative experiences with her. And I saw people's just terror and fear. And there's not a lot of reason behind people's fear of snakes and serpents. There's a very deep-seated terror and fear in a lot of people. Some people move towards them with no fear at all, and other people, when it's there, it's kind of unexplained, and it's deep and core.
Is it related to biblical teachings?
I don't know. I just think it's something in people's psyche or something. The serpent is so mysterious. But at any rate, I saw a lot of people have beautiful experiences with Shiva Luna over the years.
Any particular
children
and apples?
You know, I was doing a group once, and this woman, we were all sitting there, and Shiva Luna was in the middle of the floor, and it was a serpent dance class, and she was in the back of the room, and she was in the back of the group, and she said, she raised her hand, and she said, I have to tell you that I'm having a hard time even being in the room.
But she signed up for the class.
She came to the class. She could not sit down in the circle. She was standing up behind the people and said, I might even have to leave. And so I said, thank you for sharing that. I'm glad you came, da-da-da-da-da. She stayed in the room. Shiva Luna was very quiet that day, and she hadn't actually moved because
mm-hmm.
she was about ready to shed. She was all wrapped up in a circle in the middle of the floor. We did this movement. She didn't move. The snake did not move for most of the time. We got back in a circle, and the woman sat right directly across from me, and she sat in the circle. While we're in the circle, closing the circle, Shiva Luna went directly to that woman.
Mm.
And I'm telling you, the circle of 25, 30 people with our jaws dropped open, she turned and she went directly towards this woman. As we all watched, she was witnessed in her fear and her terror.
Right.
And she just breathed and she kept looking at me and I looked at her, and Shiva Luna had right to her knee, then as she was sitting there, went around her body and rested her head on her foot.
Probably the most peaceful thing she could do.
It was amazing somehow that it occurred like that. We were all blown away. It was like, this is no plan of anyone's.
Well, that's greater consciousness than I would tend to give to a reptile. I could see it with a dog.
Yeah. Something was at work there. And like I said, it was a very magical path that Shiva Luna and I had together for that many years.
I wonder if you can describe, because as much as I'm fascinated with snakes, I think they're beautifully mechanized creatures.
Mm.
I still think of them as being closer to the basic fight or flight type of consciousness as opposed to the more forebrain that we have.
Yeah, they don't have much of that.
So how do you know that Shiva Luna connected to you differently than, say, another human being that would be feeding her?
Well, I was smell.
Okay.
And vibration. So that tongue, you know, the tongue goes out and it collects information and it brings it back in. So there's a gland like in their head that actually kind of tastes and reads the vibration. So it's smelling, but it's not quite smell, it's more complex. And the criteria that comes in is really limited.
Okay.
So they don't have a lot of reasoning of like, oh, is that so-and-so or is that so-and-so? It's more like, is that dinner?
Or am I dinner?
Right. Right. So somebody even says sometimes once with snakes, it's like, thirsty, you know, hungry, thirsty, horny, sleepy, or something like that. It's
right.
Really just kind of the tracks, food, drink, sex, sleep, whatever they're wired up for.
Is Shiva Luna a sexy snake?
I thought she was pretty sexy. She died a virgin, though, I will say that. She never quite had a sexy date.
Uh-huh.
She was getting to the size. She was at about the size where I could have mated her when she got sick. So
okay.
I didn't get a chance to actually mate her, but there was a male in the county and that they were going to have a sexy date. But anyway.
Does the Burmese python tend to be a gentle snake?
They do. They're a constrictor, and they get huge. I think part of what happens is they get so big that they really could hurt someone.
Like I might say about 6 inches in diameter.
They're really big. Yeah, they can be super fat, like that big. That's more than six or so. Yeah, you're right. So they're heavy, they're big, they're constrictors that get so strong, but they're not super testy. They're not some of the testy ones. They're a little more, they're more manageable, especially if they're raised in captivity.
And you keep them fed.
Yes.
So then why did you phase out of snake dancing?
It was time. It felt like it was time. And Shiva Luna, I had two boa constrictors. They died about a year and a half apart, and I had them since they were a month old. So that was actually really fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then Shiva Luna passed away about 2.5 years ago, and it was time. It was just a natural shift. And you know, I've gone deeper in other directions in my life, which I think was really timely.
What did you shift to?
I got a little deeper into my healing practice, and a little deeper into working with people, and my hands-on healing work, and less performing and more leadership. So I felt like I worked out the burn that I had to perform and be an entertainer, and to do showy stuff and dance and do, you know, I was producing and directing performance art pieces with many, many players and characters and music and this and that. And I just kind of wrapped that whole aspect and kind of put it on the sideline. What became more interesting for me was facilitating ceremonies and teaching and doing groups and teaching workshops and doing my healing work, my actual healing practice that I do with individuals as well.
You probably learned as a performer a sense of connecting with the audience, working with an audience that probably serves you well in terms of ceremonial guidance and facilitation.
Yeah. And I've facilitated a lot of groups and circles and rituals and stuff. So I feel really comfortable now, which I feel happy. I feel happy to say I feel comfortable inside my own skin. I feel really, it's really very, it comes very naturally to me. I love to take group places. I love to drop people in, to just offer an invitation for people to go someplace they don't just go on their own so naturally, or especially in groups.
Can you remember the first time you led such a circumstance?
I don't remember the first time.
Or a significant time.
Well, I've been teaching for many, many, many years. And
what have you been teaching?
Swimming and athletics. When I was a kid, I was an athlete and
uh-huh.
a swimmer. So I taught a lot of swimming ever since I was a teenager, lifeguarding and teaching swimming. So I've been kind of teaching and being an educator forever. It was probably had to do with body tails. There's a movement modality that I've studied for over a decade with a woman named Olivia Corson in Oakland. She's in the East Bay. And that's I started teaching that, and it really dropped my leadership in. And it was also teaching a class that involved movement and story and, you know, holding sacred space and keeping it safe, holding the container. So it was a lot of those components started to drop in for me. It wasn't so much ceremony, but I was teaching classes and holding a big space for people.
And see, Olivia was a mentor.
She is a mentor of mine.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Incredible mentor, actually.
Where'd you grow up?
In Marin County, California.
Oh, you did it right here.
Yeah.
Okay, so it was a little bit more alternative of probably life growing up than the average middle American kid, I'd say.
Yeah. Marin County was different then.
Let's see. What was it, the 70s when the...
Yeah, 70s, 60s, okay. 70s, yeah.
You know Rita Abrams?
Oh, Mill Valley, yeah. California.
She's still in Mill Valley.
Wow, that was really sweet. That and then the hot tub and the,
right,
the whole
the
Marin County
feathers.
Thing, the peacock feather in the hot tub.
Yeah, the cereal, I think it was called.
Right.
Okay. So from athletics to snake dancing. Well, in terms of the holding space and the ceremony, in a sense, you're kind of creating community.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand community is a large part of what your work and your consciousness is about. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a bit?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think that's partly why I'm so passionate about it, is that the part that I play seems important, bringing people together. I call it sometimes the art and craft of gathering, gathering in new and different ways, and getting better and better at it. Because I feel like as the times change and as we have an accelerated time in our life here, it's more and more important that we're able to connect, to network, to share resources, to be even get on the same page, to share values, to reflect for one another as you and I were talking about around our personal growth and evolution, our conscious evolution. We really need one another. We need to be able to listen. We need to hear, you know, witness one another. I think as people we have a huge need to be witnessed, to be seen and heard. And there's a lot of poor listening going on.
I mean, that's one of the greatest tragedies in our nation, is that we're told to listen as we're growing up, but we're not given the experience of being listened to. And so we really don't know how to listen.
Yeah, it's really out of balance. You and I were talking about relationship and partnership and, you know, important components of that, and in community as well. It's like, can everyone be heard, and can we also be authentic? Can we
do
be
we have
real?
the safety to be authentic?
Right.
Which Obama is struggling with at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, so holding container for me, I feel like it comes in this, I wouldn't normally call myself this, and it's stepping a bit out of the closet to call myself a priestess. But that's truly what I am. I'm a priestess.
Okay,
so we can call a man a priest, but we don't necessarily call women priestesses.
All right, so for the left brain among us, explain what that is.
I'm a sacred space practitioner. I'm an ordained minister, for one thing.
Okay.
So I am ordained. I consider myself a spiritual guide and counselor and steward. So I could call myself a steward. A priestess is a steward. She stewards the community. She stewards the temple. She stewards a spiritual experience or an experience of spirit. So she's the gatekeeper, and she's also, you know, the minister and the space holder. So a priestess really opens up space, facilitates experiences, holds court, kind of, you know, as a container, holds sacred space. So in my experience of when I feel like I'm offering the essential tools, you know, in circle or in community, in a group, certain things get in on the ground floor when you set sacred space. You have safety, container. When you set the space, so much more is possible. Where the group can go, the experience they can have, how much depth we can have, how much authenticity, how much trust, how much vulnerability, how much transparency, or is it just going to be a la la blah 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 circle with a bunch of talking heads?
So will you hold your container, all those possibilities, and those who have gathered may or may not know what that's about, or what you offer?
They come along.
Okay, because I would gather there's a couple ways where you hold this. One is where, I guess, if you do your own classes, or you create an event and you invite people to come to that event, are there people that bring you to their space, and maybe their space is a little more corporate, you know, and they're being brave, and do you ever find yourself in a real dichotomy?
I'm available for more of that.
Yeah.
That's a good use of my skills, is to go into a more conservative or more straight-laced environment, more professional. As I think those kind of skills could be well utilized in those environments.
Because what you probably bring is what the American Indians used to do before every meeting, or maybe they still do. But it's when I think about the difference between the business environment, which runs the world today, and in the American Indian history, how they ran the world, that before they started every meeting, they honored, you know, four directions, and it was earth, sky, you know, water, and fire.
The natural world.
And what they represented was, one hand, the material world, another hand, the spirit, then the heart, and I'm blanking on the fourth. I guess logic, the mind. Okay? So that all four were in balance. And if you go to a corporate meeting, heart and spirit are out of the equation. And what's in the equation is logic and resources. What are the resources? How do we work them to our best profit? And it's one of the reasons a corporation can do so much damage, because it sees itself solely in terms of its value and resources and not in terms of its benefit to the community in terms of heart and spirit.
Right.
So I see where you can bring this energy and try to bring back to balance.
And it that to me is also, you know, symbolized in what I think is very up in a lot of people's awareness and consciousness, which is the feminine must be brought back into balance now. So what you're naming there, what we weren't necessarily calling the feminine, but I would say that the feminine sensibilities, which has more to do with earth and sky, heart and soul, spirit, it's more whole. The feminine is gonna hold a more whole perspective or whole integrated approach, which doesn't leave anything so obvious out.
Right, and your challenge is overcoming a system that's a couple thousand years old.
Yeah.
And I think the King James Bible, part of the rewriting was to further entrench the patriarchy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's entrenched. And there's a lot of issues around that, but I would say it's the sensibilities of the feminine. It's you know, like you were saying, bringing spirit, you know, back into the boardroom.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if we have much chance if we don't start balancing things like that out some more. Natural resources and, goodness sakes, I'm not sure.
Yeah. And then there's an irony between the boardroom, per se, and then when those executives go home, and what is their home life like?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where's the balance in that?
Mm-hmm. One of the things I've done in ceremony quite a bit, I do a lot of dedications. Like at the end of a ceremony or the end of a group, we'll take the energy and we'll dedicate it.
The for merit, closure?
Yeah, we'll dedicate the merit of the work, of the blessings of the prayers, to all beings. So that's a very general, you know, dedicated to all beings. But when you have that power built up, when you have that resonance really big and rich and full, and you have, you know, you've been going for a while with people and everyone's humming, you take that power and you can kind of direct it. You heat it up, you know, we rub our hands together like this and kind of raise the fire, and then take all your awareness and you send it out. One of the things I've been doing is doing some magic where we're sending the feminine sensibilities and a gentle, sweet, surprising humility to our global leaders. So it kind of wanders in while they're sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can find them when they're docile and sneak up on them with this surprise of reason. You know, that's what I would want to implant in them, is some reason, fairness.
It's not too much to ask, is it?
It's not too much to ask. Just a little bit of the feminine sensibility and common sense, a little bit more reality.
Yeah. Well, that, of course, what comes to my mind, I think I sent you my paper on predatory leadership.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I think so many people in those positions do not have that capacity.
Mm-mm. Compassion, balance.
If they had compassion
harmony,
and balance, and empathy, they would not have instigated policies that lead to the devastation in today's world.
Right. So that's where I feel like is doing good magic, is just to send them these little fairies that dance around on their shoulders and have them feel delight and simple pleasures in life, which I think people lose track often of. Simple pleasures in life, just simple joys of being a good person. It's humanity. It's really the humanity. I was recently in Bali for many months. I was there for 3 months. It's a beautiful culture. And one of the things that I enjoyed the most was really sharing laughter and humor with people of another culture that generally couldn't really speak a lot of the language. So most of the time, we weren't speaking the same language, but we were able. I was able to have an interaction with people that got us all laughing. And that was my favorite. It was one of my highlights. It was very simple.
Can you describe the story?
Just the sweetness of day-to-day, laughing together. I had some women that worked for me in the compound where I lived, and they would pick up my laundry for me, or they'd pay for my vegetables when they got delivered, and often I'd have change coming. I would just give them some money. And then it got to be this funny joke where she wouldn't have the change for me, I wouldn't get it or something, and then we started to have this ongoing joke like that was her extra money on the side, was her pocketing my change. So we would laugh about it, and we would just, and then I'd give her some money, and then I'd look at her husband and look at me, and it just become this day-to-day, we just had such a gas with it. It didn't mean very much, it was funny and it was sweet, but you find something that's cute and you can feed it a little bit, so you have pleasure and joy and a lightheartedness about your day. And I found the Balinese were very sweet that way. They were always willing to just be present and laugh, and you could make them laugh so easily, and just making the silliest thing, you know, sweet.
So they enjoy their lives.
They do. They enjoy them even.
And no iPods.
No iPods. It's really a simpler way of being, and their humanity is closer. It's closer in. That's why I was bringing it up. They live much closer to themselves and each other, and the food they eat, where they live. It's not complicated. Their lives are not complicated, stressed, and you know, strung out every day from moment to moment with a to-do list and a BlackBerry and a you know, a car phone and a this and that, buzzing, beeping, vibrating on the hip all day long.
In terms of tourism, is it getting crowded?
You know, it's coming back up now after they took quite a hit. Well, they didn't take, that wasn't so bad in Bali, but what did hit them quite hard with the bombings.
Right.
That happened a number of years ago, and they're on the rise. It's kind of coming back now. Australians are willing to come back now, and tourism's picking up, but they were in a major growth spurt when that happened. So it caught them kind of mid-stride with building some things, and so it's been many, many years of having a real lull there in their economy.
But what change did they have to make to feel secure?
I think it was the world that needed, and outsiders that needed to feel secure to come back, that there wouldn't be another incident there. The Balinese are so spiritual in their daily life.
They go
to the temple every day. They're Hindu.
So not Muslim.
Because
Indonesia is like the world's largest Muslim population.
Correct. With Bali, a Hindu island, there in the middle of the biggest Muslim nation. So they felt like maybe they were responsible or something because they believe in karma. They go to the temples every day. They jump through the hoops that the priests of their local villages and temples, they lay out the line of this and that, and they do it. They do their customary spiritual practices that are written in stone. They, from the time they are raised, they stay on track, and their family units are very important. So they're very devout people. They thought that they had, I don't know, they deserved it, or they had done something wrong, or to deserve that, or something. That's just their nature. What do they do to bring that on?
Yeah, that's sad. But I think a lot of people, a lot of caretakers, those of us who grew up to become caretakers, as opposed to predators, which is one of my theories, the caretakers take on responsibility. You know, it's one way they assuage it. Mm-hmm. It's like taking care.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We were talking about community and relationship. Do you want to talk more about that?
Sure. Where should we dive in on that one?
What are the options?
Well, I think you and I hit it on the nose. when I was sharing with you about my wonderful relationship with my sweetheart named Forrest.
Uh-huh.
And I find it to be fairly easy, not easy, but it's fairly smooth. I'm watching a lot of people around me with some drama and constantly breaking up or one foot out the door half the time. And there's something that going on with Forrest and I that I feel like we're modeling something really beautiful. It has to do with maturity, emotional maturity and emotional literacy. And we have a high level of respect for one another. As we both said, we thought was very, very important. And
you can hear each other. You listen to each other.
We listen to each other. When something's up, we listen. And both of us are very, not quick to apologize, but we apologize to each other. We take responsibility for our own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That is key. I'm willing to take responsibility for my own stuff, especially if we're really hearing each other. We drop in together. I can say, you know, I'm sorry that, you know, I was tense when I brought that up with you, and I'm realizing that I wasn't. It wasn't a good time. I could have brought that up at a different time. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, too. I didn't mean to jump on you. You know, so we basically really, really own our own part. And then what I'm learning is that it unravels really easily when you do that. You don't have layer on layer of resentment and reactivity that just keeps layering on each other. And then you're just, it's a mess. It's a reactivity mess.
If you stay in a victim role where you're throwing blame at each other, then one, you keep putting up walls and you keep throwing more ammunition. So it's difficult to, because the resolution, in one definition of an argument, is two people each claiming to be the only victim and then trying to prove it.
Right.
And that is kind of a losing dynamic. But once you, as you say, take responsibility, then you create a vacuum for blame. And there's a space for something else to blossom.
Yeah. And I find, you know, again, we were talking about this not only in relationship but also in community, and that is the self-responsibility, you know, part. Having self-awareness and being self-responsible and having an inquiry process, you're actually interested in your own behavior and in your own growing edge, you know, that self-inquiry, self-assessment. Wow, I really noticed that when I talked to you earlier, I was tense. You know, my belly was a little tight. I wasn't really breathing. I think I was still uptight from da-da-da-da-da phone call that I got and, you know, that self-tracking.
All right. Well, as a mediator, I also go to the duality. So I'd say, okay, when I said that, and I apologize for saying that, I know what I broadcast, but I don't know what you received. So to have interest in how you receive each other, and to have, because often when people hear a different opinion come out, they feel threatened by that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, how can you think that way? And my suggestion is, well, they do think that way. So the fascinating thing is, I do want to know how you think that way.
It's really nice to have a connection with someone when you actually like their mind.
Yes.
I think that's also a key. Maybe Gemini and Gemini. I'm a Virgo and Forrest is a Gemini, and it's very mercurial. Sometimes I think our astrology can really show up in a really beneficial way. And communication-wise, I think that's a good one for he and I. Somehow we were able to speak the same language often enough to get us through wobbles or... And I think sometimes people just are not speaking the same language.
Well, the wobbles are part of your diversity, and I think that makes life a little more interesting.
Yes, 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 yes. Good life on the edge.
We mentioned earlier that children are told to listen, but they're not given the experience of being heard or listened to. How would you teach a child to listen?
You know, I feel like important aspects of that are presence and embodiment. Posture.
Okay, I'm 6 years old. What's embodiment?
Yeah, what's embodiment? Well, if a kid was doing, you know, was distracted with a ball or was had a toy and was shaking it or something, and I was talking to them, but they had something else going on, I wouldn't trust that they were really listening to me. So I'd want them to stop and be present. So what I would do is I would create presence if I really want to be heard, especially with a kid, and I would probably touch them. If I felt like I really wanted to make sure that they were present with me and connected with me, I'd probably touch them in some way, on the shoulder or on the hand, or I'd create a gesture or something that connects us. So when I'm delivering a communication, I have an energy connection simultaneously.
Okay. Outside of, say, an emergency where it's get out of the street.
Right.
Would you provide listening for them first?
What do you mean?
I find that when people are bursting with things to say, they have a hard time listening.
Good point.
And if the other person is also bursting, then neither can really hear each
other. Right, good point.
Right. And kids are so much more about, they are the center of their universe. So to receive an acknowledgement and to be, when I do parent-child mediation, sometimes I realize, I think it's the first time in the kid's life that they've been heard by an adult, which is me, without judging, without moralizing, without trying to fix, without interrupting, simply accepting what they have to say as their truth.
That's probably one of the biggest keys to teaching it. What, don't you agree?
Exactly.
Modeling that. Thank you for bringing that up. And I think it's a good opportunity for reflective listening.
Yes.
If a kid says to me, you know, it's like, wow, I hear you. I hear you that when your daddy took that truck away from you, it really hurt your feelings, really made you mad. I hear you that that made you mad. And I think, I mean, I think that works with any age. I think it's really a key to good communication, kind of reflective listening.
Yeah, I have a little story that's in the book I just showed you. When I started mediating, I got a phone call from a woman who said, we don't want a divorce, but we're fighting and it's getting worse. Can mediation help us? And I said, definitely, come on in. And I heard their story, and part of what I could hear was that their communication skills were pretty challenged. So I taught them active listening. And so active listening is, as I'm hearing
kind of
you.
What I just did.
Yeah, when you, I feel, because when you slam the door, I feel anxious because it's really threatening and bothers me, something like that. So I said, I want you guys to go home and practice for a week doing the act of listening. And they agreed to do that, and they come back a week later, and I said, how's it going? I said, well, it's going okay. By the way, folks, this little Yorkie just walked through my store. Hi, Buddha.
Yorkie's here.
We have a Yorkie named Buddha who's getting a walk.
Hi, Yorkie named Buddha.
Are you listening, Buddha? Yeah, you're listening. He's listening and licking.
That's the cutest little thing.
Yeah. Okay. So they came back and they said, but it's a little awkward. We have to stop. We've got to think, okay, when you, okay, what am I feeling? I feel, and why? Okay. But when one of us is doing it, the other one realizes we're trying to say something important. So we are listening better to each other. But the mind-blowing thing was, we've been doing it for a few days, and all of a sudden we realized our four-year-old daughter was doing it. And that really blew me away.
Mommy, when you did this...
Exactly. How our kids model when we don't realize they're modeling our behavior. So that's... and I wish children got this. We're able to have this experience.
That should be required teaching in grade schools, communication techniques. I actually have a whole series of curriculum for life skills for children.
I love it.
Life skills.
Tell me some life skills.
Oh, my gosh. I have, well, one is the listening, and one is, there's another one that I would tell the boys. It's 101. This is 1A for boys about girls.
Okay.
I have a whole thing for boys about girls and a thing about girls about boys.
Excellent.
One is the owner's manual to the opposite sex.
Okay.
So you can really get with the girls and
have
talk
about
it. Have
you started to write this yet?
Yeah, I have a bunch of it written down.
Okay.
1A for boys is, honey, I hear you. That's it. I hear you. No fixing, no walking away, no. I hear you.
No patronizing.
No patronizing. It's like, honey, I hear you that you're angry. Honey, I hear you that you're frustrated.
Which is receive. Receive the feeling without qualifying it.
Yes.
Simply open up and
exactly.
Accept
that's
the feeling.
Just hear them.
That would change the world.
It would change the world. That one thing would change the world. If men could just hear what a woman has to say. Half the time they just want to be heard, and it'll shift. They might just be heard and experience being heard, and then from frustrated to sad. And they might be raging one minute, and then they're crying in your arms because they actually got heard, and they could work through the...
And have you created a safe enough space to let them express? All right. So what's the flip side? What do you teach the girls?
The flip side of that, what I teach the girls, is that boys often need to go away and have space. And that when a man needs to individuate or go into the cave or something, they actually do some critical, crucial personal time on their own. When a girl might pick up the phone, she might chat with a friend, she might want to talk about it, a boy is more likely to take a walk by himself or to sit quietly and to process in some ways on his own. And I think that there's something about the individuating that needs to get accepted. But when a girl or a woman won't let that happen, they're either insecure or they're just in his face, they don't really let him have the time out he needs, then it can blow because he's not quite making sense maybe of everything he's feeling or needs to work it out. And sometimes we need to just let them take a few steps or a day. Or
I'll get couples in mediation where, as you say, one needs the quiet time, the need to reflect, mm-hmm. and the other one needs the engagement.
Yeah.
So as the one starts to retreat because they need that quiet time, then the other one is like, wait, you're retreating. And
right.
I don't come.
And then
know.
It becomes clingy almost and invasive. And
so what I tell them is, you have created an exquisitely perfect conflict. It is
the
beautiful.
Perfect conflict.
Conflict's running the show.
The conflict's running the show, Act 5.
Right. In terms of life skills, I mentioned earlier there was a story I wanted to tell.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a little bit jumping a bit, but I think mm-hmm. I once read this in one of the, like, Parade magazine or something like that, where a woman talked about she used to love the bad boys. They were just so exciting and
too.
So much fun. And she had nice guys as friends, but they just weren't as interesting, you know, and they'd want to get involved, and they just, you know, I don't want to ruin our friendship, and she'd keep them at arm's distance, you know. But one day, after a bad boy really broke her heart, she just didn't have the energy to push the nice guy away that was taking care of her. And it was like 4 years later, and she realized, I'm still in a relationship with a nice guy. Well, what's going on here? She did some assessment, and she realized when you date a nice guy, he's nice to everybody. If he's nice to everybody, then what's so special about he's nice to you? But when a bad boy who's a jerk to everybody is nice to you, boy, you feel special.
Uh-huh, interesting.
Until you get connected, and once you're connected and he has control, then all of a sudden his behavior starts to change. But now you're so emotionally connected, you're saying, wait, can't we get back to where it was really wonderful? It made me feel special.
Yeah, I think that's something.
I'd like to put that in your high school life skills class.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And, actually, relationships is community. One of the things I teach is that culture is specific to the population. Mm. Right now, you and I are here. Each of us alone, we have our own culture, our own habits, our own rituals. We get together, the two of us, we now invented a new and unique culture, very specific to how you and I interact. Mm. If somebody else enters the room, the culture changes.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is I think a lot of us operate on mythology. Here's how we should be in relationship, honey.
This is how it should look. This is how it should feel. This is the way it goes.
Right. And without understanding how, I call it mythology.
Mm-hmm.
So the expectations that as you're growing up, you know, behaviors modeled by your parents, if they're together or if they're apart. So fighting divorcing parents have an influence,
mm-hmm.
just like the active listening parents had an influence.
Mm-hmm.
And so culture and community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of my challenges has been, because as an idealist,
mm-hmm.
It's like, well, gee, if everybody could just expand their vision, be a little more flexible, be a little more resilient. But there are those whom change and resiliency is incredibly difficult for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but everybody looks for love. Everybody looks for acceptance. And that's, you know, one of the questions in the book that I wrote, Conversations Before Marriage.
Mm.
You know, what will your expectations be of me as your husband?
Mm.
And I don't know that that question is asked very often.
Mm.
So here I am. You're the guest. I'm talking. So anything come up for you?
Well, I think we, like we had spoken about earlier, we do work our internal work out with our closest loved ones. You know, our closest intimates are the ones that we're going to be hashing out our core wounds, our core confusion. You know, we choose the ones who are intimate to us, and often we're working out our karma with them. We're working out our contracts or our agreements from other lifetimes, or, you know, the patterns, just like you were saying. It's like, you know, you get in relationship with your father over and over again, and then you realize, oh, God, they've all been my father. This is
all these boyfriends, yeah.
All these boyfriends. It's always the father thing. And sometimes we absolutely don't see it. We're totally blind to it. And we realize, wow, this is the same wound that keeps getting re-triggered, that's been with me since I was 13, or this or that one.
Well, it's the Einstein quote. You know, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. So
yeah.
You talked about change earlier, you know.
Change is happening. We might as well. Oh yeah, that was an interesting piece. I was talking about. I took some notes actually. It was really changed ways of thinking,
uh-huh.
and the changed ways of being, and changed ways of knowing. And how did I say it earlier? I should have written that down. That was a really great bullet point. It's not thinking.
Well, you talked about change and how you think.
Mm-hmm. But changing, it's not changing the way we think. It's having thinking, old thinking, changes that happen to old thinking. It's not necessarily thinking new things. It's thinking in a new way, or thinking about old things, or thinking about the same things in new ways. So it's new ways of thinking. For example, we were talking at that salon.
Uh-huh.
That was all a lot of conscious banter going along there. For instance, someone who might talk about investment and return. If they were going to invest in a piece of property or some real estate or something, they would go through the whole process of thinking about the return in numbers.
Yes.
Dollar values. Da 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 da. Bottom line. But a new way of thinking would be to invest in land. And the return would be
sustainability,
fruit trees,
yeah.
gardens, resources,
community,
water in the ground, community. So that's a new way of thinking about value, investment, return. That's what I was thinking about, is actually applying new ways of thinking. And that's what the new ways of being, changed ways of being. Like, I'm learning how to be, you know, in my relationship, in certain ways, they're changed ways of being. I'm not being the same as I have in relationship in the past. And I want to, what I was talking about with you is that being conscious and aware of the changing, of the changes, of the changing, and the changed ways of being.
And enjoying the process.
Enjoying the process and being kind of awake in the process.
Uh-huh.
Then we're acknowledging our growth. We're acknowledging our own evolution. We're in more conscious evolution because we're conscious about it. Wow, I'm really changing, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
I think that's called a dialectic, right?
Is that a dialectic?
I think a dialectic is where you are changed by what you are thinking and saying. As in conversation, mm-hmm. you and I are being changed as we have our dialogue.
Uh-huh, dialectic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think we need more and more of that. We need to be in relationship and communication and community with a willingness to be changed, to be inspired, to be evolved in the moment by the awarenesses, by the inspiration, by the language. I think new language is key.
Yep. We're always looking for the non-sexist pronoun, I think it is.
The new ways of languaging is really key. We're winding up here.
Yeah, this is the point where Jan looks at the clock, starts silently pointing at the clock to tell me to wrap it up. But I thought it was a perfect place. You know,
yeah,
it was a very positive note.
Evolution.
And I think we could do many more interviews here. We're just starting to open the door on that. How do people find you?
Well, I have a site that's called sacredministry.com.
That's a good line.
Yeah, www.
Sacredministry.com.
Sacredministry.com. And that's the best way to reach me, love@sacredministry.com.
Okay.
That's my email address.
All right. Well, I think Seth is listening. I want to thank you so much, Elizabeth, for being here, and definitely want to have you come back again. Matter of fact, when Jan is here, you and Jan will have a totally other conversation.
Great. That sounds great. Thank you so much, Matt. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Elizabeth Moriarty. And I think Seth has got to play some of Jan's music from her album, As Above, So Below. It opened, by the way, the music that opened the show tonight was Jan's song called Seven Sisters. And Seth is about to close the show with Jan's song called Taloa. I hope I pronounced that properly. Thank you all for listening. Next week, Al Haas, who's a musician here and a doctor. So an MD, who's a really great singer-songwriter, will be our guest on the 7th of May. And on the 14th of May, Steve Seskin, just another incredible, incredible writer-performer. You may have heard a song called Don't Laugh at Me, which Peter, Paul, and Mary have been doing. So he will be our guest on the 14th. Thank you all. Have a wonderful night. Take it away, Seth.